Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
This episode is sponsored by Amazon Handmade. Amazon Handmade is the destination to find unique handcrafted products created by artisans and makers from around the world. With categories like home and kitchen, jewelry, baby, beauty, stationery, and even pet supplies, you'll be sure to find something you love, all while supporting small businesses. Plus, handmade items make for incredible gifts. Check out my gift guide for this holiday season at amazon.com/handmade holiday. Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Where, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today on the pod, I'm speaking with the co-founder and CEO of Mejuri, Nora Sakija. At the helm of Instagram's favorite fine jewelry brand, Truly, they have over 800,000 followers to date. It's no surprise that Nora's background is deeply rooted in the jewelry world. In fact, she's the third generation in a family of jewelers. Still though, Nora's path was anything but linear. Instead, she found herself studying industrial engineering before getting her MBA at the same time she was working at one of the top financial institutions in Toronto. But after 5 years, she decided to return to her roots on her own terms. Tired of the traditional messaging that jewelry should be purchased by a man for his partner, Nora built her brand around the idea that women, or anyone really, should feel empowered to buy fine jewelry for themselves. Today, the direct-to-consumer brand uses a weekly drop model and blends traditional craftsmanship with modern manufacturing to create an industry-disrupting company. To date, Nora has raised $32 million in VC funding and leads a team of over 190 people. She is so intelligent and so savvy, and we are lucky to have her on the show. Now, on Second Life, it's Nora Sakija. Should we jump in?
I'm ready.
All right. So we like to start at the beginning on this podcast. So what did you study in school and what did you want to be when you grew up?
I studied industrial engineering and then I did an MBA. I was a dreamer growing up, so I wanted to be a lot of things. But I come from a family of entrepreneurs. And so I've always wanted to run my own business. I was fascinated by manufacturing for some reason. I love the idea of creating products and how to run manufacturing. So that's why I got into industrial engineering. And then I thought to myself, you know, manufacturing, engineering, I should learn German and move to Germany. And let me tell you, to try to learn a new language and to try to learn German when you're older is really hard. So I ended up in Toronto working in craft in their factory in an internship for engineering and essentially got out of that out of my system. And that's how it begins.
So what made you decide on industrial engineering? I know that you are the third generation of a family of jewelers. So I'm curious about whether you ever considered that a potential career path.
I've always had jewelry in the back of my mind, something that I was passionate about. I always wanted to go back to it. And so, you know, being a third generation jeweler, I wanted to venture out, figure things for myself. And to be honest, I consider that a very, you know, refreshing and good move since I came back to the industry with a completely different perspective.
Okay, that makes sense. So if my research is right, you went on to work in consulting at one of the top financial institutions in Toronto. So tell me how you got that job, what about it interests you, and what that learning curve was like.
Yeah, so it was, you know, it was a dream job for me because coming out of engineering and getting into the field of engineering, so it's really highly relevant, was very, very important. And so, you know, getting into that job was a big milestone for me. But the learning curve was very steep because I had just moved to Canada. I started a part-time MBA at night. I didn't know a lot of people. So you can imagine the learning curve on every part of my life was completely, you know, steep. And so I think that was a turning point for me. That's probably one of the key experiences where I started to build resilience.
Right.
Very just life-changing.
So while you were in that job, as you mentioned, you were also getting your MBA. Why did you decide that was the right move for you at the time? And what was the most valuable thing that you took from that experience?
So coming out of engineering, it was very technical and I knew I wanted to start my own business. And so in the back of my mind, I've always wanted to go back to jewelry, but I didn't have the business acumen at the time. And so complementing the technical skills with business was very important for me. And so I think, you know, the network that comes with it, the thought process that comes with it was great. But to tell you the truth, the learning that you get on the job is probably, or starting a company is probably 100 times more valuable than any education I've had in the past.
That is very honest. So you're in Canada, you're working, you stayed there for about 5.5 years. And during your time, you went from being a process analyst to a process specialist. I have no idea what that really means. So I'm hoping that you can explain what the work was and how your responsibilities were changing and the most important things you were learning during this time.
Yes, so I was working in almost an internal consulting agency, even though it's part of the bank, but essentially it starts off, so we're very much project-based. And so as an analyst, it's exactly what it is. I'm preparing reports, crunching numbers all the time, really helping the leaders on the project to get the information that they wanted. And then over time, as you progress, you start to take on and lead projects and cross-functional projects. And the whole premise of it is, how do we improve efficiencies? How do we improve customer experience? How do we deploy technologies across the bank? So started to take on more and more components, you know, apart from the technical or problem-solving skills that I would say I learned extensively. I think one key thing for me that was very important is people management. And I worked under someone who was great. My manager, for the most part, essentially was the same person. And so I got to see him in different situations and see his leadership skills. And I learned so much from him on how to handle issues, how to grow a team, how to manage a team. And so I think that was, if I would say that was one of the key learnings, having that example was really key for me.
I always think that you learn so much from your bosses about, if you're lucky, you learn what to do. And if you're not lucky, you learn what not to do. But either way, it is a very informative and personal learning process. So what was your favorite aspect of the job? And what did you not love during that time?
I loved the people I worked with. I loved that it was project-based. So I got to work with different people. I got to solve different problems, see different parts of the bank. So that was very important for me, the variety and just seeing different things. I think if I reflect back towards the end, I was really missing that feeling that my role or the work that we do, is it part of the big picture? How does it impact, you know, how does it impact things in a bigger way? And I think, you know, this is, I guess, the entrepreneurship urge that you get. And this is where I wanted to sort of have a bigger impact or have more control over the things that I do.
Got it. Okay. So eventually you decide to leave the bank and you decide to start your own line of fine jewelry in 2015. How long were you thinking about the idea? How long did it take from that initial idea to actually making the leap? And then what was that time like for you?
It is a process. Oh my God, I don't even know when the starting point is. I started to think about it and put some thoughts here and there in 2013, but really we accelerated implementation, or we sort of got into the implementation mode in end of 2014. Essentially, we joined a business accelerator in the beginning. And so the first 3 months were quite intense in just getting the website redesigned, the brand more obvious. And so we launched in 2015. And that, as part of the business accelerator, we essentially got a little bit of funding. I also had started the company in Toronto, where there was a ton of focus on entrepreneurship and startups. And so I was able to win some business plan competitions in addition to some self-funding. So this is how we got by for a bit. But it really is a process. It's something that I've been thinking about for quite some time. But it really, when I started to bring different team members together, that's when I started to feel we're accelerating the implementation. And that was at that point. It was our chief creative officer, our CTO, and our COO. So we're the founding team members. And once we all got together, it was a much faster time frame.
So what was that initial idea? What was the initial proposition in your mind? And has it changed, or has it remained true to that first idea?
So coming out of the jewelry industry, or being an insider to it, I essentially saw that a lot of positioning in the market is classic pieces targeted for men to buy for women, very gifting heavy. And so that is the perspective that we didn't want to continue on. And so we started Majuri early on talking about women buying jewelry for themselves. And I remember one of the first videos that I had about the company was talking about women don't have to wait for men to buy them jewelry. So I would say it's essentially held true throughout the journey. And it's something that is a core value for us, is just changing the behavior of how people view and buy jewelry. But obviously the products have been refined, the brand continues to grow. And so there's a lot of things that had evolved, but I would say the DNA of the company had stayed true since the beginning.
So I would imagine that having these roots as a third generation jeweler meant that you had an understanding of the industry that most people didn't, that would really help with the development. So I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about the aspects of the business that you did know really well and some of the things that maybe you had to educate yourself on.
I think following my father, I've learned so much from him, and particularly around product, manufacturing techniques, gemstones. I used to, you know, sit and read about gemstones and really imagine pieces. So there was a lot of focus on product, I would say. And my father was very much, for him, it was very difficult to understand how to sell jewelry online, because the connection with the customer and the customer experience is really important. Building trust is really important. So sort of these values were super, super important. Obviously, at that point, the family business was really focused on retail stores. So I never had built a brand before, which is a very complex portion of the business, but very, very exciting.
Very.
Yeah, it's honestly, building a brand is very exciting, but also not an easy step. And it's building that consistency, the brand values, the depth, the connection with your community is really exciting for me to be part of. And also e-commerce, so technology and e-commerce, something that I hadn't experienced before, going from traditional retail stores, one-on-one selling techniques, you know, and very, very different approach to selling jewelry to going onto online and building a community. Very exciting, very steep learning curve, but completely different from where I came from.
Okay, got it. So let's go back to 2015. It's launch day. How did it go? How are you positioning yourself in the market? And most importantly, do you remember what that initial offering was? What was the assortment?
Sometimes we look at pictures of the older products and we're like, wow, we had evolved. So there was quite a variety in the product from a style standpoint. And I think we started off focusing heavily on vermeil, which is sterling silver with gold. But we had immediately emerged into introducing a lot more 14 karat products with gold and diamonds. And so definitely the materials had evolved, the selection had evolved, and we've also stuck to the everyday aesthetic, which is more simplified aesthetic that you can wear on a daily basis and less occasion based. So there's definitely an evolution from the product standpoint. But you know, launch date, I can never forget the launch date because we launched out of a business accelerator. And so I had to present the company to, you know, a lot of people, primarily people in business and people in technology who don't necessarily understand jewelry. So it was quite interesting. But like I said, the positioning of the company was about women buying jewelry for themselves from the get-go or changing the jewelry buying behavior. So I think that I get reminded by our early investors of the vision and how it's held true, but obviously all other aspects had evolved quite tremendously.
Was there a piece in that initial assortment that you particularly loved, or a piece that did so well that you were surprised about, or a piece that you knew like this is going to be a bestseller and then it was?
We had initially, very, very early on, we were working with a few independent designers. And I remember this ring that we were known for. It was called a Zamrud ring, which is, you know, very intricate design. And it had a big green stone that is not necessarily your everyday aesthetic. It's a little bit more out there. And I remember when we launched it, it got a lot of recognition. I had no idea that would be the winner. We kept it for a few years and then... Yeah, and then we evolved the aesthetic of the brand, but I still remember this ring and I still talk to the team about bringing it back. It was the starting point of the company, and you know, I have this emotional connection with it for sure.
Oh, that's sweet. I love that. You should bring it back as an anniversary drop. Wait, speaking of drops, so in the summer of 2016, so about a year and a half into your business, you introduced your very successful weekly drop model, which obviously is big in the sneaker world, but is not as well known in fine jewelry. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that decision and the heavy investment you made in your supply chain in order to properly execute it.
So when we decided to go and create a brand for women to buy jewelry for themselves, we, you know, something that was really important for us is the freshness and the newness of the products. And it's not to say we had to produce a lot more products, but it's more of how do we stay current and how do we stay in the conversation with our customers. And like you said, it's a model that's been there for fashion, but it hasn't been there for jewelry. And we started to ask ourselves why and digging deeper into it. So the first thing that we've done is we've redesigned or rethought, let's say, the design process. So instead of thinking seasons or instead of thinking, you know, 1 to 4 introductions per year, we started to have a continuous flow of designs, you know, looking at trends or creating our own trends or having conversations with our customers with what they wanted to see within the aesthetic of Mejuri. And so having that flow of designs is one thing, but like you said, the investments to actually making it happen is another thing. So we had to align ourselves initially with a few manufacturers who have compressed timelines, who believe in what we're doing. We didn't want to overproduce and mass produce products. And so we wanted to make sure that we continue to introduce things with high quality, limited quantities, and really understand what our customers want before we invest in these products. And so it became part of our DNA, where now all of our partners across the world, we manufacture all over the world, we have similar timelines with them, and we really feed our design process or our design calendar to our manufacturers depending on their expertise. And so obviously started off very small, and we needed to get that traction to onboard more and more manufacturers. And it's always a work in progress. But I believe, you know, customer experience is not about how you deal with the customers afterwards, but how can you deliver consistently with a consistent quality, consistent cadence. And so that was an advantage that we've I guess instilled in the company from early on, is not just look at the product aspect only or the brand aspect. We also looked at the infrastructure from day one so that it can scale with the scale of the business.
That's so interesting. Also, I had no idea that you would have different manufacturers that specialized in different things in different parts of the world. That's fascinating. How do you find these manufacturers? I feel like that must be such a difficult research project.
So the different parts of the world is really key for us because different products have different specializations. So say if we want to produce chain, it would be with a very specialized manufacturer for chain. If we want to design, you know, sterling silver versus vermeil versus 14 karat and diamond. So each manufacturer has a core competency that we like to leverage. We get connected through the industry, but primarily there's you know, industry shows that we are part of. We also work with manufacturers who are Responsible Jewelry Council certified. So they have to have been vetted by a third party to make sure that the supply chain is sustainable and ethical. And so there is a source for us where we go and find, you know, manufacturers and align ourselves with them. So really different ways. And as soon as you start to know, expanding the industry, you start to get more and more introductions.
Okay, that makes sense. So let's talk about raising money. So that same summer, the summer that you started the Drop Model, you also raised your first $1 million in seed investment from 500 Startups, which is an early stage venture fund and seed accelerator. And then 2 years later, in 2018, you raised another $5 million in a Series A round. I'm hoping that you can walk us through how your needs for capital changed over the course of your first few years of building the brand. Obviously, you need more money as you scale, but other than volume, what specific investments along the way became necessary in building a strong brand?
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. I mean, fundraising is a world in its own. It's an interesting process, but I will tell you, I had raised over 30 million. The first million was for sure the hardest. It was one of the hardest experiences for me. Because naturally, when you're raising seed funding, you are raising on the promise of the idea materializing and on the team. And obviously, you know, at that time, like I said, a lot of people were talking about AI and complex technology and VC money is going towards all of these industries. And jewelry wasn't necessarily one of those industries that were deemed to be exciting. And so I had a lot of convincing to do. And it took me about more than 6 months to raise the first million, which was quite hard. But as soon as we got it, and I think, you know, we learned a lot. We essentially put our heads down and really focused on what delivers value for customers, and really focused on making sure that we deliver the best products, customer service, evolve the company. But to your question, in the beginning, the fundraising is really geared towards bringing some people on board who are key to help you build the business. Right. And that's where, you know, the dollars go and obviously create the products. But as you continue to grow in scale and you've proven that there is a product market fit and that people really actually like your product or your brand, you know, you put a different lens to it. And I think for us right now, fundraising is to accelerate growth and to implement on larger strategies. But it's also a way to align ourselves with investors who can really support the brand, who can open up doors, who are very strategic for us. So they become part of the team and they become part of building this company to take it to the next level. So it goes from really a need for capital to survive to more of a need for capital to really grow and hit the next stage, not just from a monetary standpoint, but a thought process and access to people and support. We've been very selective as to the investors who are on board because we really wanted to align ourselves with investors who believe in building a brand and that we can't take shortcuts or just to grow faster and that we wanted to build a big brand that stands the test of time. And so that was very essential for us when we were fundraising. And that becomes sort of something very important as you go into your Series B and an ongoing series of financing.
I think that's one thing that's so important for people to hear. And it's something we've talked about on this podcast before, but like there's lots of different types of money out there. And I think a lot of times entrepreneurs get dazzled by this idea of like, these people are going to give us this much money, but it's not that simple. Like you need that money to work for you. You need that team to work for you. Like you're interviewing them as much as they're interviewing you, because if you're doing it the right way, that money should come with strategic help and alliance and also investors who have the same vision that you do. Because if that is mismatched, it can be a world of pain, to put it mildly.
100%. And I think one key thing too that I used to hear back in the day is take as much money as you can. But I don't necessarily agree with that. Take as much money as you need to hit the next milestone so that you can continue to build value in your company and not necessarily, you know, get in tough situations. And once you get this money, you have to spend it. So if you don't know where to spend it on, then you're setting your entire infrastructure up for a very tough situation.
Agreed. Okay, so let's switch topics slightly and talk about social media, because Missouri has all, it's coming up on 1 million followers on Instagram, just Instagram alone, which is insane. And especially so because I think it's so hard for brands right now to garner as much community engagement as you have. It's really remarkable. So I'm curious what you attribute that success to.
Instagram has been super instrumental for us. And I think there's multiple reasons why we got here. One of the, I guess, the basic and simplistic ones is Missouri on the inside, I always say, is Missouri on the outside. So it's quite intuitive for us or for the team to be, you know, relevant and continue to be relevant with our community, because we're essentially one. And when we started in 2015, and we started to align ourselves also with social media influencers early on. And so we started to create that community very early on before the competition had increased. And so now we have a community, and we do all of this internally. We've never outsourced any relationship building outside. So they're genuine relationships that we have internally, and we've nurtured them over time, and we continue to expand them. So I think the time at which we had launched and the time at which we had, you know, started our community building was really, really key for the company to get to this point. I do realize that it's a lot more competitive at this point. You know, we've established something called the Fine Crew, which is a group of influencers who really love the brand, love our mission, are authentic about their involvement with the brand. And so we partner with them genuinely on what they like to present. And so it doesn't feel like a transactional relationship. So that was key component for us. Marketing has been in-house, and also our creative agency is in-house, which I think in an indirect way also impacts this. Again, with the content that we create, the messages that we put together is all coming from the same source. It's all internal and it's all consistent over time. So I think that also helps us bring that level of consistency with our community and makes it easier for us to connect and grow our community.
Very much so. Okay, let's talk about shopping on Instagram. Do you find that to be a big revenue driver as well? Because I'm always interested in strategy around conversion through Instagram. And more specifically, do viral posts of a product always translate to sellouts?
So one thing that I also feel very strongly about is that jewelry had been sold for a long time as a product where we talk about it in a very technical way, like the specs of the diamond and the specs of the gold. And so I wanted to bring this along with styling together and make sure, you know, that the styling component is part of the conversation as well. And so that's where I see the connection between Instagram and our growth. And so how do we see, you know, different women are styling jewelry and how people are referencing them when they're coming to Missouri to buy the product. So definitely super relevant. In terms of the viral posts, if they are the ones that sell out, that's a really good question.
because it's not like, it doesn't always translate. And there's such a variety. It's like, sometimes it's like, oh, seeing it on this celebrity or this influencer, like that's actually the thing that moved. Or like this photo did really well, but no one actually bought it for whatever reason. Or this photo didn't do as well, but it sold out in seconds.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I think it depends on the product, but I completely agree with you. It's not necessarily a one-for-one relationship, for sure, because there's so many factors that go into viral posts. So I think you're right. I think I wouldn't draw a one-to-one relationship, but if the product is one of our classic lines or the essentials, I would say the more viral it goes, the more the indication. But if the product is a little bit different or has a unique touch to it, that's when I feel like it's not a one-to-one relationship.
That makes sense. Okay, let's go back to money again. So in 2019, in the spring, you closed a Series B round of funding. And this time you raised $23 million, which alone on its own is astonishing and amazing. But to top it all off, you were also 7 months pregnant with twins during negotiations. And I cannot imagine what that was like. I'm hoping that you can walk us through it. I mean, it's just, that just sounds wild to me.
It was crazy. Do you know that I was signing the papers when I was in the hospital one day before I actually gave birth? It's so funny. The doctor walks in and I'm signing paper and he's like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Working." Because I had preeclampsia, so I had to be in the hospital for some time. And so towards the end. But the journey, you know, I went into it being a little bit nervous, quite frankly, like fundraising when pregnant because when I was fundraising for our Series A, so my husband and I, we worked together and we were fundraising together. And I remember in Series A when one investor had asked, you know, "Do you plan on having kids?" Which I thought was, you know, an interesting question to ask. Yes, to say the least. So, I never had imagined that would be one of the decision criteria for some people. But when I went into Series B, you know, I was worried. I had that in the back of my mind. But obviously, thinking about it, it's a way to sort of vet out these conversations. Everyone I had talked to was amazing. I've done a lot of the conversations over Zoom, which we know now is you know, it's possible to actually do business over Zoom. So it was an interesting experience for sure. But one thing I have to say is I started building relationships with the investors that we ended up with way earlier before. So this is essentially what I try to do, is whoever we want to go in partnership with is to actually spend time with them. And I know that investors do appreciate that because they want to know you as a business operator for some time. They want to know the business. They want to look at you over time as opposed to sort of one point in time. So, you know, looking back, I think that was the key thing that had allowed us to really close it in a relatively short period of time, but definitely was a crazy experience. And then I went on mat leave for 3 months after that, right after we closed the funding, and I came back to the company after 3 months, and there's like new faces, new processes, new everything. And my goodness, it was like a new world after Series B as well. So lots of changes in a very short period of time that I had to go through.
That sounds astonishing on so many levels. Also astonishing is the fact that your brand has grown like crazy, with 4x revenue growth year over year for the past 4 years and almost 200 employees across offices in Toronto and Buenos Aires and showrooms in Toronto and New York and LA. When you have that much growth, there are always challenges that come with it, from having a grasp on company culture to organizational restructuring. What have been the biggest challenges for your company in that regard, and how have you worked through them?
I think, like you mentioned, the company culture and organizational restructuring is probably the first that comes to mind. Because imagine you're growing much faster than, you know, it's faster than you can put processes in place. It's faster than you can hire people for the changes. And so that's been a continuous catch up. And obviously, you know, it's taxing for people that are taking on more and trying to catch up. But it's also energizing for certain types of people because you're always learning something new and people accelerate in their careers much faster. So I think, you know, there's two ways to look at it. Definitely challenging from an organizational structure standpoint, really questioning yourself. Do you have, you know, the right people handling the areas that are growing very fast? Do I have the right structures to support them? Culture is really, really key for us. From day one, we were very protective of the culture. And when you're growing super fast, you really have to put measures in place to make sure that it continues to be intact. So it's been a wild ride for sure, but it's filled with excitement on the other end. And that's super, super rewarding for me personally, to see the team growing and really hitting their dreams or achieving what they wanted to achieve.
Well, it sounds like that mirrors your own experience as well.
100%. The amount of growth that, you know, a CEO, a first-time CEO that has to go through in this period of time, my goodness. But it's exciting. It's really exciting.
Well, it better be exciting or else it would be very, very difficult. So I have this theory that the things that we learn in our first life, in the first part of our career, are often quite applicable to our second lives. So I'm wondering if you could tell me about some of the skills that you were really honing, resilience, for example, in your first life that are helpful for you today as an entrepreneur.
I think the experiences that we talked about previously in terms of moving countries, starting something new, you know, not knowing a lot of people, like that portion of my life that I mentioned earlier was really important to your point to build resilience. And to be honest with you, this year was testing for every leader in terms of resilience. And I think, you know, I had a little bit of foundation there that maybe helped me push through it. And starting off with engineering, I know I talk so much about engineering because I truly love it as a way of thinking, and my team makes fun of me of how much I love numbers, but essentially it's problem solving. It's thinking in a structured way. It's really analyzing things. And so I think for me, it served me big time to really have that background, to have the analysis skills, to have the problem solving skills, and to have that resilience in where I am today. And obviously, I don't know everything, and I hire for these areas that I don't know or I'm not necessarily deep into them. And so that's also something that I've learned along the years, is as much as it's important to focus on your growth and to focus on learning, but it's also very important to recognize which areas are key in the business that you actually have to bring super specialized and amazing people to run them.
I love that. So you mentioned that this past year has been difficult. Obviously, it has changed just about every business in the world and everyone in one way or another. Being D2C, I would imagine that you are in a much better place than brands who have a really heavy, heavy brick and mortar presence. But I'm wondering how the current climate has most deeply affected your company and in what ways you've had to pivot or adapt, besides the fact of being a trendsetter and being comfortable with Zoom before everyone else was.
So we were actually this year in the process of expanding retail. So we were, when the lockdown started, we were in the process of opening two additional stores, which brings us up to... Yeah, we actually had to close Boston before it was ready to launch, and lockdown had happened. But we have six retail stores. We were one of the first companies to make a decision to close all stores. We really had... wanted to make sure that the safety of our customers and our staff is top of mind. And so we made that decision early on, which obviously is a tough decision to make, and had impact, you know, impacts the revenue of the company immediately. But I stand by that decision at any point in time. So that was something that we had to do immediately. Other things, to be honest, that came to mind as soon as the lockdown had happened is the mental health of the team, is the team involvement. You know, working from home wasn't something that we typically do at Mejuri. And so that was like a shift. And it's a shift in a tough period of time where you can't really assess if people are doing well. Like, you can't really see body language. You can't really see what people are hiding. So we had to work with our managers to make sure that they're asking the right questions in one-on-ones, that they're really gauging how the team is feeling, that, you know, how people are feeling is really important for the business and important for us because we're building this business together. And so we had to put these checkpoints in place. That was really key for us. For me personally, really moving from... I used to walk in the office, see people, chat with them, and I don't have that opportunity anymore. And so making sure that we have all hands meetings on a weekly basis, our town halls are comprehensive, that I have these opportunities to talk to the team, to answer questions in our Ask Me Anything sessions. And so having those direct lines of communication with the team to make sure everyone is comfortable was really key. And from a business standpoint, I would say aside from retail, we essentially had dropped all of our spend for, you know, out-of-home campaigns, and we redirected our spend to digital. And naturally, you know, a lot of people were transacting online, so that turned out to be okay. So definitely a lot of impacts on the business. One key thing that I also love that we've worked on is doing styling appointments with our customers. So one-on-one styling appointments. If they can't go to stores, they can actually call in and they can have video chats with our team. Yeah. And so that was key. That was also nice relationship building for us to be in front of our customers and talk to them and learn more about them. So definitely had a very quick pivot to make sure that we're close with our customers, that we're close with our team, that we're keeping, you know, retail safe. And like everyone else, trying to be as proactive as possible with the information that's out there.
So one thing that we like to talk about on this podcast is mistakes, because everyone makes them. And we live in this Instagram perfect world where everyone likes to pretend that everything is just swell and beautiful at all times. But that is not how life goes. So I'm hoping that you can tell me about a mistake that you've made in your career at some point and what you learned from it.
I think in the same light that we were discussing earlier with the fast growth, I think hiring very fast, hiring for technical skills and not necessarily assessing maybe cultural fit as much as possible was probably something that I had learned very quickly, and it would have a big impact on a high growth business. And so I think right now it's something that is very, very important for us, is while technical skills is obviously very important and competence in your job, but it's also the cultural fit is just as important. Especially in a fast growing company, when there needs to be a level of comfort with building and evolving in addition, in parallel to managing and not just managing. And so it's not necessarily for everyone, and having to vet that and be clear about that, it's a two-way street as well. So you got to make sure that they're really set expectations for them to understand what they're getting into. And you also have done your due diligence in terms of, you know, what do we expect as well?
It's just like dating. Just because someone's good on paper doesn't mean that they're going to be your soulmate, right?
That's exactly right. It's always, I always say it's like dating 100%.
So a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are interested in switching lanes in their career, whether that's a small pivot or a big leap. And I'm hoping that you could share some advice with someone who wants to make a change, but maybe is just holding back a little bit or is scared.
I think making a change, you know, you have all the right to be scared if you are, because making the change is really not easy. But the way that I think about it, we spend so much time at your job and at work. And so the closer you can bring it to your passion, the more it can fit into your lifestyle. So it is definitely a risk that is worth taking, because it's something that's reversible. If you don't like it, you can go back. But I think one thing I would do is, if there's a career change, I would try to, you know, do internships or try to do it on the side in terms of testing it, because sometimes things appear to be a lot more appealing on the outside than they are on the inside. So give yourself the opportunity to test things, or time frame to test things, I would say. And lastly, I think what's important is obviously never burn bridges. You never know when you want to go back to your original plan, because, you know, things can change. And when you try things out, it may appear to be different. So those would be my two pieces of advice.
I love that. Don't burn bridges. That's the truth. Not to mention, these industries are small. The world is small. So it does not behoove anyone to burn any bridges. Okay, so my last question is also my favorite question, which is, if you could go back in time and speak with younger Nora at any point in her career and give her some work advice, what would that be?
I think, you know, general advice I would give myself, and it's probably, you know, top of mind now because of what we're going through, is to perhaps slow down, explore the world, travel more, because, you know, don't underestimate the amount of knowledge or learning that you can get outside of work or school, and that traveling, exploring, meeting different people, different cultures is just as educational. And I think that is one thing that I, you know, if I look back, I would have done differently. There's a different taste to it when you're traveling, when you're younger, when you're exploring, when you're younger. So slowing down is not really a bad thing.
I love that. Well, Nora, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. That was so fabulous.
Thank you so much.
That was the co-founder and CEO of Mejuri, Nora Sakhija. For more inspiring interviews with women like Nora, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social. And now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show. So if you have a great idea, send it in to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show is at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life. Thank you to Amazon Handmade for sponsoring today's episode. Amazon Handmade empowers makers with the tools necessary to showcase their products to millions of Amazon customers. In categories like home and kitchen, beauty, toys and games, and so much more, each Amazon Handmade product is crafted by a talented maker. Shop today to find a gift for yourself or someone else, and check out my curated gift guide at amazon.com/handmadeholiday.